Clearly, one of the most important trends in current clinical trials is the evaluation of neoadjuvant systemic therapy, both to evaluate clinical response and tissue predictors of prognosis and response to treatment. I met with Dr. Harry Baer, principal investigator of NSABP B27, one of the largest neoadjuvant trials that has been reported. Dr. Baer reviewed the design and key findings from this study.
B27 was a successor trial to B18, which was the randomized trial of preoperative versus postoperative chemotherapy with four cycles of AC. And in B27, the objective was to determine whether adding four cycles of docetaxel either preoperatively or postoperatively to four cycles of preoperative AC would improve patient outcomes. With the preoperative docetaxel, we also wanted to correlate that with improvements in response, particularly pathologic response in the breast, which we'd shown previously in B18, the most powerful predictor of patient outcomes. So we found, in fact, that docetaxel given preoperatively did double the pathologic complete response rate, and that was reported in a previous publication. Somewhat surprisingly, after that, we did not see a statistically significant improvement in either disease-free or overall survival with the addition of docetaxel, either pre-op or post-op. I think there's a number of potential reasons for this. Some people have attributed this to the concurrent use of tamoxifen. I'm not sure that's entirely correct. It may have somewhat degraded the chemotherapy effect, but we saw no correlation or interaction of hormone receptor status with the effect of adding docetaxel. So I think that's less likely.
Before you kind of continue with 27, maybe we can just divert out for a second, because this issue of chemotherapy responsiveness based on ER is kind of a hot topic the last year or so. And there's been this question of, for example, TAC versus dose-dense AC paclitaxel.
Sure.
The TAC seemed to work in ER-positive dose-dense compared to non-dose-dense didn't seem to. Where do you think your B27 data fits into that?
Well, the B27 data are a little bit problematic because we don't have hormone receptor data on all the patients. But in those patients where we had pretreatment hormone receptor data, our data would tend to support the TAC trial in the sense that both ER-negative and ER-positive patients had a higher pathologic complete response rate with docetaxel than with AC alone. Clearly, ER-negative patients overall have a higher response rate to chemotherapy in general, and that was also supported in our trial. There was a statistically significant improvement in pathologic CR in both the ER-negative and the ER-positive patients with docetaxel. And again, whether that's a differential effect of docetaxel versus paclitaxel, I don't know, but it's an interesting question. One of the most interesting things was a subset analysis that was done to explore hypotheses, and what we did was to analyze the benefit of docetaxel according to whether patients responded clinically to AC. And what we found, in fact, was those patients that did not respond to AC didn't benefit from docetaxel, indicating those are probably chemo-resistant patients and that adding another chemotherapy drug probably doesn't help that much. In patients who had a clinical complete response to AC, we also did not see much benefit from docetaxel, indicating that those are probably good prognosis chemo-responsive patients who may not need the additional chemotherapy. Most interestingly, though, was the group of patients who had a partial response to AC, which is 40%+ of the entire cohort, and those patients had a very significant improvement in disease-free survival with the addition of preoperative docetaxel. One might ask, why didn't they benefit from the postoperative docetaxel as well, which they didn't. I suspect that that's because of the delay in administration of the second chemotherapy regimen, which in some people's terms might be considered inadequately dose-dense. And put more simply, the delay between completing AC and starting docetaxel may have negated the benefit by allowing regrowth of metastatic clones.
Do you think there are clinical implications to what you just discussed? It's always the question of what do you do with somebody who doesn't respond clinically to AC or even progresses on AC? Were your data strong enough to say, well, hey, you know, just maybe we ought to send those patients to surgery at that point?
I think it's something to think about. I think it needs to be explored in another trial. It was a post hoc subset analysis, not a planned analysis. Of course, if we'd seen a large beneficial effect of docetaxel across the entire study, we wouldn't have been doing a subset analyses to explore hypotheses. But I think it's a very interesting question. I think that there are a number of other trials where chemotherapy has been adjusted. Some of the German trials, for example, where there's been an attempt made to adjust chemotherapy based on response to the first treatment regimen. And they sort of agree that if you don't respond to the first treatment regimen, adding another drug or drug combination is not likely to bring the response rate up very high. And I think we should consider whether those patients either should be operated on or perhaps should be subjects for experimental drugs that are not necessarily cytotoxic.
Any thoughts about going back and trying to look at the tissue specifically, maybe in terms of the genomic health Oncotype DX assay?
Soon Paik is actually doing that. He presented some of the preliminary data on 92 patients. The major problem we have with that is that there is a bias in terms of pathologists providing blocks. They're less prone to provide us the blocks of the pre-treatment biopsy tissue if the post-treatment surgical tissue had no tumor in it. So among the 92 patients he got in the B27.2 sub-study, there were only 4 or 5 pathologic complete responders. What we might do is sort of make a plea to get those blocks retroactively, so to speak, from a better representation of the study and see what we can do with that. I think some people have questioned in the light of B27 whether pathologic complete response is an appropriate surrogate or appropriate endpoint. And I think we demonstrated pretty convincingly, due to the continued strong correlation of response and nodal status, that the pathologic outcomes of the patient still is a very strong predictor of patient outcomes. It's not perfect. And one of the reasons is because the patients who don't have a pathologic complete response consist of a mixture of patients who have a good prognosis, or what you might call a slowly proliferating tumor, and therefore are not very responsive to chemotherapy, but their prognosis is pretty good. And another group of patients who probably have a bad prognosis, but their tumors are just not responsive to chemotherapy for other reasons, and they need some other treatment. So I think we recognize that PathCR is not a perfect endpoint, but it is a pretty good predictor of patient outcomes. Again, I don't think neoadjuvant studies necessarily should lead to practice change in the adjuvant setting, but they certainly give us a good tool to rapidly pick regimens we ought to look at in the adjuvant setting to determine what the best treatment should be for those patients and to learn about the biology of the disease, more importantly.
Now, how many people were in the trial total?
2,400 plus patients.
So in terms of the overall question of whether docetaxel adds to AC in terms of disease-free survival, were there adequate events to be able to look at that?
I think that's one of the reasons that we didn't see a statistically significant improvement in disease-free and overall survival. And as discussed in the paper, Stuart Anderson, one of the statisticians, suggested that, first of all, the magnitude of the non-significant differences we saw were not that different from the differences seen in some of the adjuvant trials. But remember, these were not all node-positive patients. So in order to have gotten a statistically significant outcome for the magnitude of difference we saw would have required a study of roughly 10,000 patients, which really isn't practical.
That seems like a reasonable explanation.
I think it's a large part of it. I think it has more to do with the lack of a statistically significant disease-free and overall survival outcome than I think the concomitant tamoxifen use does. But there are a lot of people who have espoused that theory, and it may have hurt us some.
It probably did hurt some. And then also you've got to mix in the patients who got delayed docetaxel. At this point, what do you feel is a reasonable approach to neoadjuvant chemotherapy off study?
I think that in a patient that's been chosen for neoadjuvant treatment because they have a large tumor, I would give those patients an anthracycline plus a taxane-based regimen. Some people I know give TAC in this situation, although there's no neoadjuvant data on TAC, so I would choose a sequential regimen, like AC followed by docetaxel, or FAC followed by paclitaxel given weekly, or paclitaxel weekly followed by FAC, much as they've done at the MD Anderson. I think that there's certainly no advantage and potentially a disadvantage to waiting to give the additional treatment postoperatively. I think most of the patients that really need neoadjuvant chemotherapy, I think there's nothing wrong with committing them to an aggressive treatment course much as we would for a node-positive patient.
What about post-operative therapy in a patient who's had an anthracycline taxane but still has significant residual tumor, still positive nodes?
Great question. Certainly we know these patients have a more guarded prognosis, but at this point I don't think we know what else to give them. Certainly they need hormonal therapy if they have hormone-responsive tumors. They may need regional or chest wall radiotherapy, and we usually make that decision based on their clinical presentation as much as anything else. But right now, we don't have a systemic agent. There is a plan being worked on for a trial of new agents, probably biologic modifiers, in patients who have residual disease after what we would consider maximal or adequate neoadjuvant chemotherapy.
Can you talk a little bit about NSABP B40, the new neoadjuvant trial?
The B40 trial has evolved over a very long period of time since we completed accrual to B27. Of course, we were hampered a little bit by not knowing the results of B27, but we wound up using AC followed by docetaxel as a baseline or control group regimen to begin with. I think from the very beginning, we wanted to look at the impact of adding a biologic response modifier, and we looked at a lot of them over the period of years that this has been developed, and each one we sort of looked at didn't really pan out to have the activity that we thought indicated that it would be useful in this setting. And certainly bevacizumab has come along recently in the metastatic setting as a very promising drug, not only in the metastatic setting, but also in a locally advanced neoadjuvant setting in a study that just came out from the NCI a couple of months ago. So I think we're now poised to do a number of things with the B40 trial. One is to examine different docetaxel doublets combined with capecitabine or gemcitabine as potentially ways to increase response and improve patient outcomes, and then to add bevacizumab to the chemotherapy, which may not only be beneficial but potentially synergistic with the chemotherapy in half the patients in the three different chemotherapy groups. So that'll be the design of the trial. We'll be giving the docetaxel or docetaxel doublets first, which is different from our previous design. And that's mainly being done to take advantage of the documented synergy between a taxane and bevacizumab, but to allow us to stop the bevacizumab 2 months or so before surgery so we don't run into surgical complications as a result of angiogenesis inhibition. It allows a washout period.
So what exactly is the timing then?
So it'll be docetaxel or docetaxel plus capecitabine or docetaxel plus gemcitabine given every 3 weeks for 4 cycles, followed by AC for 4 cycles. And then the bevacizumab will be given for the first 6 cycles of chemotherapy. And then those patients who randomized to bevacizumab pre-op will also receive 10 cycles of bevacizumab post-op.
I know one of the major issues here is to look inside the tumor. It's really a different paradigm for how to look at neoadjuvant studies.
Absolutely. I think that may turn out to be one of the most important outcomes of the study. It'll solve the problem we had with B27, that is trying to get blocks, trying to get biopsies retroactively and get them paraffin fixed. So we will be requiring the submission of 4 cores of tissue prior to the randomization. 2 of those we put in RNA later to preserve the RNA so we can really do optimal gene expression profiling. Another core will be put in fixative for later use for other things we might come up with, like the genomics health assay. And a 4th core will be put in medium for assessment by a chemosensitivity assay called ChemoFX, which has been touted as a way to predict response to chemotherapy, but really has not been subjected to as rigorous a trial as this will be.
Is it just the pre-treatment time that there's a biopsy, or there are other biopsies prior to surgery?
We'll collect tissue at the time of surgery. Ideally, we would have liked to collect cores again in the middle of the chemotherapy between the switchover from the taxane to the anthracycline-based regimen, but I think we realized that that was going to present problems in terms of compliance, in terms of getting patients to agree to be on the study. Those were sort of accrual issues, but there was also the practical issue that many of these patients will have such shrinkage of their tumor after 4 cycles of chemotherapy, they may not be so easy to get a core of, or certainly 4 cores of real tumor tissue. So we dropped that out as being probably overly ambitious.
So is the real main important bottom line the pathologic CR?
That'll be the primary endpoint of the trial, but because we're giving bevacizumab postoperatively, we'll be also following patients for disease-free survival. We'll be looking at combined breast and nodal status as a response, which is in the MD Anderson terms. That's what they call a path CR, is if you have to have no tumor in the breast and lymph nodes. We'll be looking at the clinical responses and, of course, the prediction of clinical response to the particular regimens that we'll be using. So there are a lot of secondary endpoints.
You know, it's interesting in terms of how the theories have gone back and forth about how bevacizumab works. I think initially the thinking was, you know, it wouldn't really change the response rate. It would just, you know, maybe prolong disease control. And then it seems like it's consistently been observed that the response rate actually is increased.
That's one of the very exciting things about it. I think we don't fully understand exactly all the effects of bevacizumab And I had the same bias that you were expressing, that it was only going to be a way to limit the regrowth of micrometastases, which had not yet acquired a blood supply. But clearly, I think there's some evidence that macroscopic tumor may shrink in response to bevacizumab, or the shrinkage may be synergistic between bevacizumab and chemotherapy. And in this study of 21 locally advanced patients, most of whom inflammatory breast cancer that just came out from the NCI, they showed very nicely that the cancer cells express VEGF receptor and the phosphorylation of that receptor is dramatically downregulated in patients who respond to bevacizumab. So there may be a significant effect on the tumor cells directly as well as on the tumor's blood supply.
Yeah, that was a fascinating paper. I interviewed Sandra Swain about that. Any more comments on that study, particularly some of the flow that they looked at, the clinical responses, et cetera?
They were quite dramatic. And the nice thing they did in that study was to give all the patients a single treatment with bevacizumab alone so they could at least get an idea whether it did anything on its own before they added in the chemotherapy. And they saw some clinical responses, they saw dramatic responses in blood flow. So I think it's a very interesting study. Biologically, I think portends for some very exciting results from our trial.
Except I have to say, sitting on the sidelines for the last 3 years, kind of watching this evolve in colon, lung, and breast, is still confusing as hell to me. Another thing she talked about was the fact that the patients who had redness and warmth in their breast, that decreased fairly significantly with the bevacizumab.
Right, that's what she showed in her pictures. You know, it's hard to know what the redness in the breast is due to. We always think of it as due to lymphedema and lymphatic obstruction of the tumor and dermal lymphatics. But obviously redness implies a capillary blood flow issue, and the bevacizumab must have some impact on that.
I'm curious about your perception as a surgeon on docetaxel versus paclitaxel. All your trials have really emphasized docetaxel. I'm curious, sort of being outside the medical oncology realm, how you see side effects and tolerability of the two agents.
Docetaxel at every 3 weeks is pretty tolerable and quite effective. I think if you use paclitaxel weekly, it's probably equally effective and probably has a toxicity profile, as indicated by the 1199 trial, that might even be a little better. It's really just a question of whether you want to give patients a weekly treatment or whether you want to treat them every 3 weeks. I don't think paclitaxel given every 3 weeks is as effective as docetaxel given every 3 weeks and probably is more toxic.
What about the issue of sentinel node and patients who are getting neoadjuvant therapy?
I told some of our residents the other day that if you want to get bloodletting to occur, you put three surgeons and an oncologist in a room and ask them that question. There are certainly many people who feel strongly, very strongly, that the sentinel node on a patient who's getting neoadjuvant therapy should be done up front so that you know the true node status of the patient. And I put true in quotation marks. In our own experience in B27 and my own experience as a surgeon, I have not had a problem with doing sentinel nodes after chemotherapy. And there are a lot of papers, the largest of which is sort of a subset of patients in B27, clearly showing that the false negative rate for doing a sentinel node after chemotherapy is not really different from what it is done as a primary procedure. More importantly to me, I think if you do a sentinel node up front and it's positive, you've sort of committed the patient to an axillary node dissection. Whereas if you wait until some of those patients have had their axilla sterilized, and if you extrapolate through the B18 and B27 patients, about 40%+ of patients who start out node positive will become node negative if you give them 4 cycles of AC and 4 cycles of taxane. In those patients, you will avoid an axillary node dissection. And as a surgeon, concerned about the morbidity of what I do to the patient, I want to do what I can to minimize the morbidity. And the less patients I wind up doing an axillary node dissection on, the better.
I guess the question there is, what's the natural history of a tumor that starts out as node positive but becomes node negative with neoadjuvant therapy?
MD Anderson has actually published an article on that, because they do a lot of imaging and pre-treatment fine needle aspiration biopsies, and they found that patients who start out node positive and become node negative have a very good prognosis. I'm not sure it's exactly comparable to patients who start out node negative and obviously stay node negative, but the main point is that post-treatment nodal status is as powerful or perhaps more powerful as a prognostic indicator of the patient outcome than their pre-treatment nodal status, because it represents a combination of their initial stage and their response to treatment combined.
Let's talk about the other neoadjuvant trial that's in progress or in discussion, B41 for HER2-positive patients.
B41 is a logical extension of the MD Anderson's experience with Herceptin in the HER2-positive subset, showing very dramatic response rates, and is going to look at paclitaxel plus FEC with Herceptin being given either all the way through the chemotherapy or only with the paclitaxel. At this time, the NSABP has pulled back out of that trial, and it will be hopefully carried on by the ACASOG group on its own. But it will basically be an attempt to confirm the results of the MD Anderson trial, where they saw a path CR rate of over 60% in patients who got Herceptin. It will be an opportunity to acquire biologic markers, much as we're going to do in B40, and will also address the concern about whether or not it's safe to give Herceptin through an anthracycline and a paclitaxel regimen without untoward cardiac effects.
So is the NSABP going to do a neoadjuvant HER2-positive trial?
That's in development, and it's probably going to be Herceptin versus alone versus the addition or substitution of lapatinib. The plan is to give AC plus docetaxel with Herceptin or lapatinib or both.
Another area of NSABP research I wanted to ask you about was the Oncotype DX assay.
The Oncotype DX assay was developed through a joint effort of Genomics Health and the NSABP, and it required a number of steps, one of which was to figure out how to measure gene expression in paraffin-fixed tissue. Once that was worked out, then what happened was to take a panel of genes and look at their expression and determine whether you could find a group of genes or a limited number of genes that, taken together, could be used as a prognostic indicator for patient outcomes. And to do that, they went back to the B14 trial, which was a trial in which patients were randomly allocated to receive either tamoxifen alone or no treatment. All the patients in that trial were considered ER positive. All the patients in that trial were node negative. Once that was done, then it was validated in another group of patients that were treated with tamoxifen. It's also been validated in a separate group of patients not on the trial. And the power of this assay, which is based mainly on 16 cancer-related genes, some of which have to do with hormone responsiveness, some of which are related to HER2 expression, is that by calculating a score based on these measurements using a formula, I think we're entering a new era where the molecular taxonomy or the molecular profiling of tumors in patients gives us a much more precise breakdown of who's going to do well, who's going to do badly, who's going to respond to this drug or that drug or hormonal therapy. And I think that's what's really exciting about this. It's certainly not going to be the last test of this type, but it's the first.
And it was interesting that you all decided to focus on the node negative, ER positive patient. Of course, that's very common. Mm-hmm. Most patients are ER positive. Most are node negative because of mammography. And there, I guess the critical practical decision is, are you going to add chemotherapy on top of hormones?
Right. In practical terms, for a patient who's got a hormone-responsive small to moderate-sized tumor, who's faced with a decision about whether to take hormonal therapy alone or hormonal therapy and chemotherapy, we have a way to measure their residual risk, as you put it, but not only their residual risk, but also the likelihood that they're going to have a benefit from chemotherapy. Now, in our working group, we're talking about applying this kind of profiling to patients with node-positive disease. There are node-positive patients who do well, and I know some of them quite well and personally, and it's not clear that just because you're node-positive that you will necessarily have a bad outcome or necessarily benefit from chemotherapy. So we're talking about our next generation of, quote, what we used to call node-positive trials. Perhaps we're approaching the time where we're going to talk about doing trials for high-risk patients, and that will include patients who have negative nodes and a bad score or a high-risk score. And it may exclude patients who are node-positive but have a low recurrence score. And so I think Soon is in the process of looking at some of our node-positive trials with this kind of assessment to determine whether we can, in fact, identify good-risk node-positive patients and separate them out. We recently had a woman who was a physician and a strong family history. She had a family history. We'd seen her before, talked about prevention, declined, came back, what's going on now? We got her mammograms and reviewed her supposedly negative mammogram and saw an obvious cancer. So she had a cancer that was about 1.5 centimeters in diameter. She had negative nodes. She opted for bilateral mastectomies. She had a hormone-responsive tumor. But she was really torn about the whole issue of whether to do chemotherapy or not. She's got young children and really wasn't sure that she wanted to do it if it wasn't clearly going to be beneficial. So we did send her tumor sample to Genomic Health, and it came back with a very low recurrence score, which put her in a situation where she was very comfortable doing hormonal therapy and not chemo. And I've got two other patients who are older, in their late 50s, early 60s, both of whom have tumors around a centimeter, centimeter and a half, ER positive, but a little worrisome because they're not strongly ER positive. And of course, the way we do hormone receptors by immunohistochemistry is a little crude in terms of strong and weak. Normally, in a lot of practices, any patient with a 1.5 centimeter tumor who's otherwise healthy is probably going to get a recommendation for chemotherapy. Both of these women were very hesitant and very resistant to the idea of chemotherapy. We sent their tumors off for Oncotype. Both of them came out as intermediate risk patients. Now, that's not going to be an easy decision for them, but it shows, you know, in the intermediate risk group, they've got a risk of systemic recurrence around 15% or so, which is pretty substantial. I think most women faced with that information would probably opt for chemotherapy. Although I must say, we don't know for sure how much benefit that intermediate risk group gets from chemotherapy. I think they would have an easier decision if it was low risk or high risk. I've got another young patient who had a 1 to 1.5 centimeter small T1C tumor who really didn't want to do chemotherapy. And again, we had real problems with her insurance covering the assay. Genomics Health eventually did it, I think, for gratis. She came out with a very low recurrence score, and she was very relieved and very comfortable not to do chemotherapy, which was her preference anyway.
What do you think these two women with the intermediate score are going
to
do?
I don't know. It'll be interesting to see. I think at least one of them, I'm pretty sure, will probably do chemotherapy because I think she's more in the subset of patients who are anxious about their outcomes and don't want to look back 10 years from now and say, darn, I should have done that. Now I've got a recurrence and I could have prevented it.
You know, it's interesting about the insurance company not wanting to pay, although I think now we're seeing that it is getting reimbursed.
Right.
Medicare is reimbursing it. And I guess one of the issues is people are starting to realize that if it really is utilized to decide whether or not to use chemotherapy, it probably is. I guess Gary Lyman has looked at this. It probably is cost effective. I mean, for example, now you've just avoided the cost of chemotherapy.
Right. Which is $20,000, $25,000, $30,000. The assay is $3,500. It takes a very careful analysis of how many patients don't do chemotherapy as a result of the assay and the money you save to offset the costs of doing the tests in patients who do get chemotherapy. So it seems, from a non-economist or not an expert in cost-effectiveness, it seems logical that it would be cost-effective, but it takes a more careful analysis to prove it.
Yeah, I mean, and not that cost should be the primary determination of what's done, but we are looking at that more and more.
Sure.
With some of the more expensive agents coming out. And I guess the other issue in terms of cost is if there's a woman who, without the Oncotype, would have not gotten chemotherapy, who now gets it, and as a result has a 75% reduction in relapse rate, you've reduced the cost of treating relapse, which is very significant.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Sure, that's a good point.
The last thing I want to ask you is a little bit about your take on endocrine therapy. I'm curious, for example, in these women that you just mentioned in their 50s, I assume they're postmenopausal?
Yeah, I think both of them are.
What's your usual approach been, or what's the approach of the oncologist that you're working with in terms of hormone therapy in postmenopausal patients?
I think by and large, the postmenopausal patients who don't already have an issue with osteoporosis are getting aromatase inhibitors up front. I think the ATAC results are hard to get away from. On the other hand, in patients who've been on tamoxifen for a year, I haven't jumped to switch them all to an aromatase inhibitor and probably going to follow the paradigm of some of the other trials and leave them on their tamoxifen for a couple or 3 years and then switch them over. Probably because I think they'll get some bone density benefit by staying on tamoxifen for a while and start out at a better baseline when we switch them over to an aromatase inhibitor. There will be a trial, the B42 trial, which is going to be a duration question, which is going to look exactly that group of patients who've been on either a combination of tamoxifen and an AI for 5 years or an AI for 5 years to determine whether they should go on an AI for another 5 years. So it's a 5 versus 10 year question, reminiscent of the B14 re-randomization that we did many, many years ago.
And I guess we've gotten much more sensitive to delayed relapse in women with ER-positive breast cancer. It really is kind of a change in the last few years in how people view that. It seems like people are now almost as concerned about years 5 to 10 as they are 0 to 5.
That's one of the behaviors of breast cancer that's somewhat unique compared to the other cancers that we treat, like colon cancer or other GI cancers. You're not out of the woods if you make it to 5 years. And I think most women are beginning to realize that. I think we all realize that. It can be indolent or occult for many, many years and pop up, and ER negative patients have a much higher relapse rate in the first 5 or 10 years of their history, but that after that, the ER positive patients have a higher relapse rate. So I think it is something we need to address.
What's your take on the safety and tolerability of the AIs versus tamoxifen?
Certainly, they have some advantages compared to tamoxifen in terms of the risk of uterine cancer, which, of course, if patients and women's had a hysterectomy, is not an issue. I think the concern about osteopenia and osteoporosis is probably the biggest downside to the aromatase inhibitors, and it requires that you keep track of it or treat it with bisphosphonates of some sort to try and limit the morbidity of that. It should at least be monitored, if not treated. Of course, that, for a surgeon, becomes a whole area that we're not used to being into, and I'm not sure most oncologists are either interested or experienced in wanting to deal with these other issues. We're all being forced to, because if you're treating patients with AIs, I think you have to address that issue. They do have other side effects. I've had a number of women who can't tolerate them because of the muscle aches and so forth. And then we can always drop back to tamoxifen if they're willing to. And I think they may have a little bit less of the hot flashes or a little less severity of hot flashes, although they still have them.
Any sort of global take that you have on just general quality of life on one versus the other?
I've been particularly interested in asking women that I've switched over, how do you feel now compared to when you were on tamoxifen? And I think although a few notice some improvement, most don't really notice a lot of difference. The issue of bone density and fracture is going to take a long time to come out in the wash. But certainly if you look at the ATAC trial, there were not huge differences in the quality of life symptomatology, except maybe vaginal discharge and vaginal bleeding, which was, of course, related to the uterine effects.
I'm curious where you see the aromatase inhibitors fitting in terms of prevention, also in terms of DCIS, ductal carcinoma in situ, which you're studying right now. And as a prelude to getting your take on that, can you summarize the STAR trial results and prevention that just came out?
A very exciting trial, comparison of tamoxifen and raloxifene, which many people know as Avista, a drug that's approved for treatment of osteoporosis. Basically, randomized trial, only postmenopausal women involved, women at high risk, as in the P1 trial. And the bottom line was that Avista was equally effective at preventing invasive breast cancers, but with a somewhat better side effect profile, with significantly fewer uterine cancers, fewer thrombotic events, and fewer cataracts, I think were the main advantages of raloxifene. So with an equal efficacy, now it was not equal efficacy in terms of DCIS, but on the other hand, DCIS is not a life-threatening disease.
So you're saying tamoxifen is more effective?
Was a little bit more effective at preventing DCIS. But what we're really trying to do is prevent patient deaths, and those are caused by invasive breast cancer. So in the primary endpoint, which is invasive breast cancer, they're equivalent in efficacy, and Avista has a better side effect profile.
What do we know about the rate of endometrial cancer and deep vein thrombosis for Avista versus nothing?
Well, we don't, except I think from some of the osteoporosis trials. I'm not sure they had enough patients to really evaluate that. There was more than a handful of endometrial cancers in the Avista group in the STAR trial, but it was certainly less than in tamoxifen. And then in the P1 trial, there was a baseline rate of endometrial cancers that occurred in the control group or the placebo group. So I think that's something you have to expect regardless of the drug.
What about the age correlation with deep vein thrombosis and these two drugs? I think that in the P1 and the premenopausal patients, it really wasn't an issue.
It's mostly an issue in older women.
Is that the
same? It's also an issue in women who have some inherited tendency towards thrombotic events. Of course, these are all postmenopausal women. We have no premenopausal women in the P2 trial.
What do you see the next step in terms of prevention research?
Well, the P4 trial, which is going to take off from that, the plan is to compare raloxifene, which we consider to be the winner of the P2 trial, to an aromatase inhibitor. And I think they've settled on the name Stellar.
What happened to P3?
P3 was a colorectal prevention trial, which died with all the other celecoxib studies because of the cardiac effects of celecoxib. We actually, in the colorectal working group, talked about some possibilities for a new colon prevention trial. I think we need to settle on a number of things. Who are we going to study? Is it going to be secondary prevention in patients who've had colon cancer in the past? Is it going to be patients with familial colon cancer? And what are we going to look at? I think the agents we're interested in looking at are probably aspirin as a dose question, because there's some conflict as to whether high dose or low dose aspirin is a more effective way to reduce polyps and colon cancers, and statins, the lipid-lowering drugs.
How do you think it's going to play out in terms of prevention with the AIs? Of course, you already have a major study going on comparing tamoxifen and anastrozole and DCIS,
right,
where a lot of that is a prevention strategy. How do you think when it's all said and done, which maybe, who knows, 5-10 years from now, the AIs are going to fit in, if at all, with DCIS and prevention?
By extrapolating from the ATAC trials and from some of the trials where patients were switched over from tamoxifen to aromatase inhibitors, I think there's a significant likelihood that they will be more effective at preventing new cancers in high-risk women. I'm extrapolating from the contralateral breast cancers that occurred in those other trials. So I think that's a pretty exciting prospect. I think the other issue we need to look at is, what are we going to do with the premenopausal women? Because we're not really addressing them anymore. We're sort of stuck with tamoxifen for those women. Although, on the other hand, tamoxifen is not nearly as tough a drug to give to premenopausal women. They have less menopausal symptoms with it. They have less risk of endometrial cancer and less blood clots, as you pointed out. So it would be nice to have something with a better side effect profile for those women as well.
The last thing I want to ask you about is adjuvant Herceptin. And not so much to get into the details about the data, because we've done that a lot on this series.
Right.
But I'm just curious what it was like for you personally, being such a key part of the NSABP, you know, see this evolve over the last year, particularly when the data broke.
Well, it was certainly very exciting. And it was exciting at the level of having accomplished something important as a cooperative group. But it was also very exciting to think about the patients that had been put on the Herceptin arm, those patients who were on the control arm who were going to get Herceptin now and probably derive almost as much benefit, and to take a group of patients that we knew had a really degraded or inferior prognosis compared to their HER2 negative colleagues or other patients, and be able to bring their level of outcome and disease-free survival up to a level that was really the same as women who didn't have this bad marker. It was pretty gratifying.
I'm curious sort of what the response has been within the group. Is it something that's kind of motivating people and been a big part of the psyche of the NSABP at this point?
I think it certainly was a morale booster. You know, as the first biologic that we really had tested in a big trial, I think it certainly encouraged us to press ahead with some of the other growth factor inhibitors and monoclonal antibodies and small molecules that attack the biologic targets that we're beginning to learn about. I think the most important aspect, and what I talk about with students and residents about the Herceptin trials, not ours and the others, is that it's a fantastic validation of the scientific method. I mean, this is a cell surface receptor described in basic science studies in the test tube 25 years ago, and that was followed doggedly through the in vitro studies into animal studies, understanding the translational importance that it was a prognostic marker in women with breast cancer, making an antibody to this receptor, humanizing it and making it a clinical drug, studying it in advanced disease, and finally bringing it to the adjuvant setting, a process that took 25 years. But that's how it works. And in this instance, it worked. Now, a lot of drugs, a lot of concepts die on the way through this process, but you have to follow through. And I think it's a terrific vindication of the scientific clinical trials process.
I think it's also a terrific vindication of the whole concept of randomized trials that the NSABP and Bernie Fisher has been so strong and taken such a leadership role over decades. And this is a prime example of, theoretically, maybe it should have been a really difficult trial to pull off. I mean, you had an agent that looked very promising, and if we weren't so committed to the randomized trial method, I could have seen another high-dose chemotherapy and bone marrow transplant scenario when everybody just went out and did it. And yet our patterns of care studies of oncologists consistently showed that right up until the date that that data broke, they were not putting patients on Herceptin who weren't on trials.
Interesting. Well, I mean, people do jump ahead of the trials.
But they didn't in this situation.
Yeah, there's so many examples, and I don't want to point to anybody and necessarily embarrass anyone, but there's so many examples of really strong retrospective comparison data or data showing promising new drug compared to historical controls that really, really look like it's a sure bet that when they're subjected to randomized trials, just don't make it. Why that happens, we don't understand. I think what it tells us is we don't know everything. No matter how well we balance groups of patients for the factors we know influence their outcomes, we don't know all those factors. And until you do a randomized trial, you can't tout or claim that a drug or a treatment has benefit.